welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And, of course, today we're going to have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, and also physics, science in general, and assorted topics. I thought today would be a good day to talk about the plan. And you might say, the plan of what? Well, the plan is really about, we'll say, a giant concept of what Earth is here for, and what and how Earth fits in with some parts of the rest of the universe, why and how life is being developed on Earth, and for what purposes. And in addition, you could say the plan is the metaphysical and esoteric, that means hidden, ideas of how we are eventually becoming an integral part of God, our creator, through co-creation. Not just because we're doing like some kind of prescribed plan of, we'll say like a show or a puppet show where we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, but more of we're doing what we choose to do, but it is still stimulated, we'll say, by there being goodness in the universe that is greater by far than there is a lack of goodness, and we'll even call it darkness and evil. So this is the plan. The plan is big. It's huge. And I'm going to start tonight, and this is part one, by the way, because I already know this is such a wide subject, and there's so much to talk about. Now, a few of you out there, or maybe more, may be familiar with the fact that there are also spiritual, quote-unquote, festivals taking place at this time, and they take place, they started a couple weeks ago, and they're going to continue on. This has to do with the plan, but unfortunately, in my opinion, too few people understand what it's all about, and even of the ones who don't understand what it's about, they number a smaller and smaller number each year. And ever since kind of Tibet fell to the Red Chinese, we have had a lack of there being any kind of organized activities on a large scale dealing with those festivals, which do have something to do with the plan. So for those of you who are familiar with that, I'm just going to throw that out there so you know that we are including you and not excluding you. Okay, if you would like to participate in today's discussion or anything that you might want to add about anything related to metaphysics, spirituality, anything dealing with what we generally talk about on the show, you can do so by calling in the U.S. 877-876-5227. And in Canada, if you happen to be in that part of the world, you can reach us at 888-815-9756. So, if you would like, while we're on air, give us a call. Okay, so what is this thing, the plan? Well, I'm going to start with a concept, and the first concept is that Earth, which is a planet, is the way, is a big way that life below a certain level, which includes human beings, is focused on to develop and to create more of the creator within. So planets play a key role because without planets, you wouldn't be able to develop life at the human and lower levels, and maybe even one or two levels beyond human, it would be difficult to develop life. Planets play an important role for that reason. I'll explain why in a little bit, but the point is that's what they do. And so you have the key unit of the development of a plan being the kind of planet that is going to make up the plan. And there are seven major categories of planets, seven types. Within those seven types, there's all kinds of other categories, but I'm going to the first seven types. And each type has to do with the way the planet attracts and is focused on with one of the seven types of energies that exist within our universe. So it kind of makes that sense, if you know what I'm talking about. And even if you don't, it sort of makes some sense, I guess. And Earth is focused within, both upon, and it emits, and it has a lot more of the type of energy called third ray energy. Now, third ray energy is very interesting because more things are affected by this kind of energy than any other kind. As a matter of fact, it's so interesting that in the dense physical part of the universe, that's where we are right now, where I'm talking from, in case you're listening, hopefully from that part of the universe, in the physical part of the universe, third ray energy actually dominates completely the entire lowest part of the universe. And some of you say, yeah, but isn't the lowest part of the universe the seventh plane, and wouldn't seventh type ray energy be the dominant energy? Well, that's a good way of thinking about it because it shows that you are thinking, but it's not correct because the third ray energy has to do with one part of the way God's mind works and the way that God chose to express itself in its three parts of its expression within the universe. The other four parts are the way the energy itself, as a subcategory of God's expression, further expresses one of the elements of God's mind or more. But important is that an expression of God's mind in an energy is far more dominant, as the third ray is, than the seventh ray, which is corresponding at least to the dimension of time and space that we live in. So even though we live in the seventh dimension, the lowest dimension of time and space, where there's only one actual dimension, I know that's confusing. We live in the seventh dimension, but there's only one dimension of time and space to it. But nonetheless, that's true also. Even though we live here, the third ray dominates. It dominates everywhere. In this part of the universe. Now remember, when I talk about the universe, I'm not talking about what normally most physicists who follow the standard model in physics think is the universe. They think the whole universe is this dimension of time and space that I'm referring to as the electromagnetic or etheric physical part of the universe. Very, very small part in reality, although it's the whole universe as we observe it at the present time in most circumstances. Now, if you're into string theory, and if you're a little bit beyond that, and you're into non-standard models of physics, and if you're thinking about things that are asynchronous, then there's a good, you know, and that doesn't have symmetry, a very important issue. It is not symmetrical. Then you can definitely have an understanding that there's more dimensions to time and space, and as a physics person, you might realize that what I'm saying is that this is only what we're aware of is a relatively small part of the universe. But getting to the point, the third ray affects a huge amount of the universe, and here we are on a planet that is focused along the third ray. There maybe is some kind of connection, and of course there is, and that is the following. I'm taking this rather slow, you know, because I know these big concepts are hard to sometimes grasp. And that is that Earth was deliberately chosen to be a third ray type planet because we have a huge part of the plan for the universe, which had a very big part to play in attempting to limit some problems in the universe. And the limitations are hopefully going to have a big effect on the progression of, we'll say, negative aspects in the universe. And in order for this to be accomplished the best way possible, the third ray is the perfect ray to choose. Why is that? Because the third ray represents the material side of God's thinking. It is the action side. It has to do with activity. And it is the most poignant aspect to God's mind in terms of defining our universe. Our universe is a universe in which interaction is the key component about how life grows, is through interaction. And Earth is having an effect on this interaction throughout the universe, but an effect, at least in one of its parts in the plan, is to limit the amount of evil and dark types of growth in life, and especially in human life, because actually evil is a very focused human kind of thing. So Earth has a very specific and understandable goal, and has a specific, we'll say, future. Hopefully it has a future anyway. And it's along this third ray. And that's the reason the third ray was chosen for Earth, because it will do more if we're successful by it being along the third ray than any of the other of the seven rays. And I hope that makes some sense to you. It will make more sense as I continue on and explain about this. Okay, so what does the third ray actually do? I mean, it obviously has to do with interactions, and I'll tell you this, the third ray is the most active of all the energies. If you have like an ocean, let's say you have an ocean, water is a sixth ray element. That's not a third ray element, it's a sixth ray element. But on a planet where the third ray is dominant, the water is most of the time in movement, unless it's slowed down by reducing its energy levels tremendously, which we call cold, and then it becomes snow and eventually ice. But even in those conditions, on this planet, Earth, you'll find that water moves more than on any other planet that it can be found on, even though it's a six-ray element. Well, it's a six-ray, it isn't exactly an element, it's a six-ray molecule. And it's composed of a couple different elements. One of them is oxygen, which is a third-ray element, but it then has hydrogen in it. But regardless of that, it functions along the six-ray, but on a third-ray planet like Earth, it's very active, and if you go to other worlds, it would be less active. It would be less active in its liquid state and even less active in its frozen state, where it has less energy because it is frozen. Very interesting stuff. I hope you find that interesting. So here we are on a planet where activity and interaction is like the hallmark of how things are. Now, we're kind of used to this, but I can tell you, if you came from another world that wasn't along the third ray, this place would seem like it's kind of hopped up on caffeine and you name it, maybe some other terribly, like, who knows, crack or something. Everybody here would seem like we're super active. Everything's super active. The planet's super active. Volcanoes every 25 or 30 miles of distance on the Earth, there's a volcano that's having some effect on something. It's ridiculous. I mean, I'm not talking about in a linear sense, but when you look at the whole Earth, if you wrapped volcanoes around it, you would actually, there'd be one every like 50 miles or something. It's amazing that we have so much activity going on. And we have subduction, if you're familiar with that. And everything's moving. Not just the seas are moving, the air is moving, the continents are moving, people are moving, everything is in movement, wind. And so this is the thing about where we are. Now, someone coming here who isn't used to that would find it frenetic. It may be disturbing, but we, so to speak, are used to it. It does wear us out. Our overall life expectancy on this planet is less than if we went to some other planets. Not surprising, because we're so active. I mean, even our bodies themselves are, everything's moving and constantly, and so this kind of wears us out faster than in other places. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't sound very good. How come I'm here? Because I don't really like this. So was I forced to be here? Well, that's the weird thing about it. We are all here because we chose to be here, because we're trying to work in a difficult world to provide a great service to the rest of the universe. And this planet was chosen as being the most difficult because this is a place where evil, if it is overcome, being one of the reasons the plan is in operation here, if it succeeds here, it will succeed almost anywhere. And that's very important, because if you chose the easiest planet to work on and you had a similar plan, the effects may not be as resounding throughout the universe, because then you go to planets that are more active and the plan might fail there. And whereas if you start with the most active, you start where it's really hard to live and hard for everything to grow and to develop, then that's a good place, because you can transfer the benefits that are discovered in that realm to other worlds that have lesser difficulties. Okay, now let me continue on with this concept of the third type of energy dominating on our planet. It also means that the development of life had very strange, we'll say, hallmarks. The third round of development of life, which corresponds to the third ray of the planet, caused the greatest growth during that period. That period was when dinosaurs and their ilk were running around for, give or take, about 180 million years, and they completely took over the planet. They dominated all of the life. Now, they weren't, I mean, in some, you know, there were other kinds of reptiles, the pure dinosaurs, those in the air and those in the water, that obviously are not purely dinosaurs, but they still fit in the same class. And that's when life had its most robust growth, its most dominant growth. But it doesn't mean that the plan was executed in a greatest amount during that period, because one of the elements of the plan is to overcome the new ways that evil can grow on planets throughout our universe in the next 10,000 to 100,000 years or so. And we're experimenting with this. It's like a big laboratory. Yeah, we're all rats running around. But, you see, then dinosaurs, when they were around, they weren't any humans. So although they played an important role, they did, in the development of life itself, they made life more tenacious. They made human beings, when they eventually came out of the fourth round, more resilient through the genes they developed and eventually became part, at least, of the bodies that human beings use. No, we're not reptiles. I know we're not reptiles, but believe it or not, we actually got some benefit out of that period. And all life did. All life shared some resiliency. Now, we don't have a heart and a liver that pump together that allows us to be both cold-blooded and warm-blooded as some dinosaurs were, and other kind of neat tricks that they had. But we don't need that. You see, we don't need to be super hyperactive and conserve all our energy, because we are spiritual and we can think, we can compensate for a lack of great robustness in the physical parts of ourselves and make up for it with more thinking concepts and eventually spiritual parts of ourselves. That's the good part. That's the good part. Okay, but nonetheless, so the third round was like, when I say round, it's a focus of life. When life was mostly focused around what is known as the throat chakra, when animals became very, very aggressive and very fast and very agile and so on. But it isn't the hallmark of the plan. It's just the hallmark of development of really resilient bodies. And you might say, well, look, we're not all that great. Human beings don't seem to last very long. They don't seem to live very, you know, what is it that we've got resilient about? Well, believe it or not, as fragile as we seem to be, we would not be able to handle the stresses of our world as we live in it right now if we didn't have this background that was brought up like from the very beginnings of bacteria and algae and everything and starting life. And it's amazing that we have created from this heritage bodies that can handle amazing stresses, but most of them are not so much physical, although we're not too bad at that, by the way, for human beings, as it is more or less, we'll call it operational. Because in terms of operational, physical is only part of it. It's also the ability to handle stress in many different forms. Emotional stress, mental stress, relationship stress, communication stress. There's all kinds of stresses that human beings have to endure at levels that are incredibly high in comparison to any other life form, lower than a human being. I know that sounds hard to believe. Most of you think, well, we're not anywhere as tough as a gorilla or as an elephant or as a whale or as you could name a number of different things. But the interesting thing is that if you look at all those other forms of life, they are much more endangered. They're having a much more difficult time with the stresses of the world, and they don't live in our world. They live in their world, which actually is less stressful than our world is, if you include the whole gamut of stresses. So I may be giving you news that is unusual, because a lot of people don't think this way, but humans on Earth are some of the most resilient humans in the entire etheric physical universe. As a matter of fact, they're some of the most resilient humans in the entire universe. Now, that's a little bit scary, and they are more resilient than just about all other forms of life anywhere in the universe. Now, you're going to say, oh, this guy's just being ethnocentric, because he happens to live on Earth. He thinks that they were really, really so hot. Well, I don't. Actually, I think there's a lot of terrible things about us, which I'll get into, but I'm trying to say that I want to start off a little bit of positiveness here, and I give us our due. And the fact of the matter is that we are resilient. We've come out of dinosaurs. We've come out of some of the worst creatures you can imagine. And we have survived two times the Earth being totally frozen and with almost no energy. We've survived the most amazing things, and we come from this heritage. It's hard to understand that, but we come from. We grew out of some muck that lived a mile below the Earth's surface for like 30, 40 million years. And then that's all the life that was existing on the planet. And from that life, 630 million years ago, it came about that all of the life eventually evolved. It's true. I know it's hard to believe, because I know some of you know there was life on the planet 1-2 billion years ago, right? Not longer. But that life succumbed from the freezing cold of the snowball Earth and other terrible things. Yet it also made what we are in terms of our physical nature and some other elements of us amazingly tenacious. I mean, that's where the body parts of us came from. It's not who we truly are. I don't want you to think that, and I'm talking about us in just in terms of our bodies. But nonetheless, it gave us some amazing abilities to deal with stress, going all the way back to the most ancient of times that it was starting to develop. So we're tough. Now, you might say, well, what about the rest of us? You talk about it being spiritual. What about the rest of our spiritual nature? Well, that's a good question, and I think I'll answer it. Actually, the soul that came to Earth to participate in this great, one of the most difficult of experiments in the universe, at least up to this time, decided to come here because they were already very tough souls. That's us. Yeah, I mean, in our native form, we're actually souls. And we come from the toughest of the tough. We came here because we are tough, and we chose this very tough assignment to work in a part of a universal plan on a planet with a plan that is so difficult, so stressful, working on the most difficult of conditions in order to prevail over evil and to do the things to which I will tell you more about. But I'm starting with the things I've talked about in shows past so that it kind of fits in with those of you who can remember what I've said before. So this is a great thing that we're talking about, because in a spiritual sense, not just a physical sense, which I've already covered, but in a spiritual sense, we're the tough guys. Now, what is a tough soul? I mean, it's a tough soul, you know, like souls that go out and do battle with armor or something, you know, we carry a big sword or, what is it? It's hard to understand that concept, because most people don't really get what spiritual toughness is, spiritual tenacity is. And I'm going to explain it, of course. I always like to present things in a little complexing manner and then come up with the obvious answers. Right? Okay. A spiritual tenacity is the overwhelming desire to co-create with one's creator beyond everything else. In other words, that is the first order of business, the first thing that is of purpose to the souls that seek this type of experiment that we're in here. Is that unlike other souls, which have a more mild approach to seeking to be a co-creator with their creator. Yes, they certainly desire that because that's the nature of all souls. But they do so with less of a fervor, less of a willingness to make sacrifices, and with a greater connection to and desire with those of their ilk, the ones that are common to them, that are similar, and there's different types. There's just like there's seven types of energies, or actually seven types of souls. And so the souls that came here are really seeking this ultimate model of wanting most to be as much as possible and as quickly as possible a co-creator of light in all the things around them. And they seek to do this because they want more than anything else to be one with God. Most of the souls, most of the planets, want to be one with each other first, and then with God down the line. Now, you might say, well, gee, I thought souls were a little more like we are, you know, like the ones that came to Earth. Well, human souls are not all that advanced. A human soul is more advanced than any animal or vegetable, you know, or mineral soul, but those other ones are group souls and humans are individual souls. But the human souls in general still seek to be one with each other first, and then one with God maybe second or third. I mean, it's not as pressing an issue for many souls that exist in many other worlds. Part of the reason for that, and this is not like, I'm not trying to insult or demean the souls that didn't come to Earth and exist in other worlds. I'm not trying to do that at all. I'm trying to only define the differences, because I don't think most people know these differences. And it's, you know, everybody thinks all souls are the same. Actually, that's not true. Souls are becoming individuals as they grow into oneness with each other and with God. So that's an important thing to remember. Now, we're running out of time for this segment. So when we come back, I got a lot more to tell you about this. I hope this is interesting. Of course, I haven't really talked about this before, so for those of you who have heard me before, you know this is kind of new stuff. We will be back in about 3.5 minutes. We've got an extra commercial, and you can listen to that during this time. And as I said, we'll be back soon.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hon, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And today we're talking about The Plan, Part 1. Yeah, it's going to be one of those multi-parters because I went over some of the things I wanted to cover, and I said, oh, my God, that's going to be a pretty big, you know. And then I realized that this is going to be multi-parted. But don't worry about that. I mean, hey, we're taking it at a nice pace. I hope that this isn't going too fast. I want to make sure that the concepts I give out tonight make sense and that everybody can follow. Well, I hope you can. All right, so we're talking about souls and that there's a difference among souls. The souls that choose to come to a planet like Earth, which is a rarity, and especially the fact that Earth is along the third ray, constant activity, a lot of stresses and potential forces when the incarnates of the souls screw up, that's us, you know. It produces a lot of problems. And so the souls that come here have to have this tenacious nature of wanting to co-create with their creator more than souls from other worlds. And you might say, well, what about superhumans? Well, what about souls that are liberated, they're called, like some people call masters and those kinds of beings? What are they like any different? Well, they are much closer to the way human souls are on Earth, but here, in this world, they also are more tenacious. And so it's sort of like each group, each class of souls is really a bit more tough. It has to be in order to try to create life on a planet such as Earth. That also means that there's a slowness to the development of those higher kingdoms of liberated souls on this planet in comparison to other planets. So the kingdom, the two kingdoms beyond the human kingdom, they are the kingdom of souls. Some people call it liberated souls. And then there's this thing called the planetary kingdom of souls, which is like this advanced souls that are more developed than even the less advanced ones. The total number, this is going to shock you, right now on Earth, the total number of those two groups is a little over 100. Not too many. Well, yeah, I know that sounds terribly small, and a lot of people would love it or already think that there's, you know, got to be thousands or millions of beings like that that have developed themselves on Earth. Well, there certainly are planets where the whole planet is like that. And a whole solar system may be like that, with just those kinds of beings running around. But as far as Earth is concerned, because of the slowness of development, we actually have a very small number of what people call super souls, advanced souls, liberated souls, masters, whatever you want to call them. And this is a bit of an issue. Now, what about those that didn't come into becoming super beings by going through the lower kingdoms and developing through all the stresses and the bodies and going into the human kingdom and then coming out of that? That's part of the energy kingdom itself, and not surprising, because we're along the third way. That group, which could be just as advanced in souls as the masters that we're considering, that there may only be a little over 100 of, that there's a huge number. Those, some of those include the devonic beings that include our soul's alter ego, sometimes referred to as a solar angel. There's a whole bunch of those because they're in the energy kingdom itself. They never go through the development of humanity. They help. They co-serve. They do a lot of great things. And there's a whole bunch of them because you have a shift. Compensating for the fact in our plan, in this world, for the fact that there's so few advanced souls on our planet, to compensate for that, because most planets actually do have much more by the time humanity has advanced to where we are today. A lot of those people have advanced out, but not on Earth, because it's very hard to do that. So to compensate, there's more energy, advanced energy beings, some of them called solar angels, that help out. They have to, because to balance out the imbalance in the amount of advanced souls. That's part of the plan. Where do they come from? They come from other planets and worlds, and they join here as helping beings, but they never live out their lives below what is called the higher monastic plane. And actually, they never live below the very top of the higher monastic plane. They actually live so far beyond us in dimensionality that it's hard to even compare, because they are way beyond humans. And in many cases, they're even beyond some of the superhumans. So it's an interesting point that these beings really don't get involved very much with the physical, astral, or lower mental parts of the planet. And in reality, anything beyond the higher monastic or mental part of the dimensionality of Earth is considered a causative part of this planet, and a part that the planet will never fully develop in itself. It's hard to understand that, I realize, because there's still dimensionality to Earth all the way beyond to the very peak of all possibilities. But those parts are that will never get fully developed. Earth will only fully develop, because of the nature of the kind of planet it is, and this is part of the plan again, through the mental world. And that's it. So Earth is a kind of planet that really is going to develop mostly in the physical, astral, and mental worlds. And that's it. That's where its focus is. And that's where the beings that work in this world the most interactively are living. And so these greater beings, including solar angels, actually are very non-interactive with the planet, with the beings that live on the planet, including human beings. It is rare a human being can have some contact with these great devonic beings, but it's very, very minimal. Even for an advanced human being, it's relatively minimal, and the reason is it's the design. You see, the design is such that these beings exist in a higher level of dimensionality than the planet even functions in. So there's little they can do to be of direct interaction with. They kind of are helpers to those that are the foot soldiers interacting in this world. Does that make sense? Yeah, I hope it does. Some of you may have read about those beings and wondered how they fit in with everything. Well, here, they're really helpers, behind-the-scenes helpers, more than they are interactors. It's difficult to see that. Now, if you're into certain religions, like Catholicism, etc., you read about angelic beings that are very active or interactive. That's probably not too true. It came out of Gnosticism, about 100 or 200 years after the death of Christ. And it was somewhat intellectualizing some esoteric information and misunderstanding it. So it isn't, unfortunately or fortunately, necessarily the way some religions will try to describe these things. Not to say that they're completely untrue, but there's some misunderstanding. Okay. Now, I know I got off on a lot of different tangents here. There's so many interesting things to talk about. It's just fascinating because this is a very big, big subject. Okay, what more do we need to know about the basics of our plan? Well, the plan is a very long plan. Earth started, I think they've got it down to now these numbers, about 4.567 or something, 576. I'm not sure. I think it's one of those numbers. Billion years ago. Not quite 4.6 billion years ago. That's when Earth, you know, seems to have been the beginning, very beginning of the planet. Now, we know that there was another planet that kind of rammed into Earth a couple hundred million years or so within that time frame after that. And it caused a whole change in the way that the Earth was developing. But I think it's critical to realize that the plan was in place before the planet was. So the plan for the planet is put together with the whole solar system. So you could look at the sun as being the basis of how the planet's going to be formed, et cetera. And knowing what kind of star you have and what kind of nebula cloud that is, you know, that is feeding into the planets and the development of them. And eventually, you know, you get into all the different dynamics. There was probably dozens of planets similar to Earth at the inception. Some of them hit each other. Some of them fell into the sun. Some went flying off into who knows where. And a lot of them just, joined together. And they became bigger planets. Some of them actually became the insides of the bigger gas giants that are not like Earth. But the plan of a planet like Earth is that you've got to be able to have life equally distributed between the physical, astral, and mental worlds so that you can have this progression going from the soul level down to eventually the physical level and back again. It's sort of like, I think of it as like a circle. And especially true of humans, this is true, but it's also true of other kinds of life too. Not all kinds of life live virtually at all in the mental world, other than the soul of that life. But in humans, it's very balanced. And the planet has to be open to being able to do this. And so you have to have a high degree of energy in the planet, in its way it's going to develop, to also keep this whole thing going for like 4.5 billion years. That's a long time. And that's where the third rate also helps, is to, if you're going to have that long of a period of time, most planets don't go anywhere near that long, your hope is to develop a very high level of eventually human civilization on it. You want to make sure that you have a lot of energy available in the physical world. Now, you might say, well, why isn't energy just all in all the worlds equally? Well, let's take a look at Mars. I'm going to give you a comparison. Mars, for the first couple billion years that Earth was around, was probably not too different. It had a similarity. It developed up to animal life on it. I know that hasn't been proven yet, but I've written it, and I think you're going to find out it will be proven. But the point is that it was imbalanced. It didn't have the balance to maintain enough energy in its system for a long enough period of time to develop humans, and to develop humans like we are, of course. So that's what it's missing. Now, we can go and we can, you know, terraform Mars, and over time we can change it so that it will become a reborn planet. And I believe we will do that, by the way. But the point is that in its native form, it was missing enough activity, because it's a six-ray planet, and it's kind of, it has a, it didn't have enough energy in particularly the physical dimension. It had enough in the etheric and beyond, but not in the dense physical. And that, so it couldn't maintain itself, and it lost its atmosphere. It had a lot of issues going on. That, and part of it is also its size. Size is, you know, size matters. And if you have enough mass of energy on a planet in the right ratios, in the right elements, the planet can keep going. But you've got to have a planet that is almost very much like Earth to be able to conduct a plan where you have advanced human civilization. Now you could say, wait a second, what did that guy just say? Yeah, I said something that's pretty important, that if you want to have advanced human civilization developing from the planet itself, not where people are going to another world like we're going to go to Mars someday, and, you know, but where it develops on the planet and evolves on that planet and then eventually spiritually develops to the human level, you got to have a planet that's pretty close to Earth. And that may surprise you. And you might say, oh, gee, but there aren't a lot of those around. Well, and there are several thousand probably in our galaxy. Now you might say, well, several thousand, but there's maybe a trillion planets. Well, yeah, there are. But most of them are not for that purpose. They aren't for the development of humans from slime in the oceans eventually to the state of, you know, being able to go out and colonize other worlds and do amazing things, incredible things. So that's part of our plan. Our plan is to do that, and you need a planet not too different from Earth if you're going to accomplish some of those things. Now, does that sound terribly ethnocentric as well? A lot of scientists say, well, why can't we have planets where humans develop that are way out there, that have, like, you know, the humans developing gas clouds above the planet and kind of float around or something. You know, the reason has to do with how the plan works. Even in the most, in the easiest, the very, very gentlest of systems or plans for a planet, there's a lot of stress to get all the way from slime up to advanced human civilization. Now, that nearly as difficult as there is on Earth at this time. I don't want you to think there's any comparison even. But you still don't, you're not going to develop human life in a world in which you have a gas giant. And the only way, quote unquote, some kind of advanced life could exist that's like human life would have had to develop somewhere, you know, 10,000 miles up in the atmosphere in some kind of sulfurous, methane-ish clouds or something. Now, you could have something that might be alive there, but you're not going to have anything nearing what we call human. And the reason for that is you've got to have this balance that allows a soul to develop and incarnate through all these stages, including the physical. And those kinds of planets don't offer that opportunity. They have too much gravity, they're too big, they lack density, though. They have so many issues. They're great for those who might live in the Buddha realm. And they might be great for some other beings that live in the higher monastic realm. But they don't work well for the eventual development of advanced human societies. Now, what about less advanced societies of humans? Much less than where Earth is right now. That happens sometimes. There are reasons for it. There are times when planets are developed to develop rudimentary kinds of human life. So that is a possibility. Our planet, though, is not that. There was no question right from the get-go, right from the beginning of this particular planet, it was designed to eventually develop very tenacious, very responsive, sacrificial, creative human beings that have eventually, as advanced, and hopefully more so if we continue to survive it, civilizations as we have today. So this is all part of the plan. It isn't an accident. It's not like, oh, well, we're just so fortunate, we're just this far from the sun, and we got exactly this amount of energy, and we spin at exactly this rate, and there's exactly this tilt, which changes every so often and gives us more movement and change. And put too much stress in some kingdoms, but, and it's exactly all these things, exactly, that make up our planet. Well, those things go to make human beings of souls that came here to do exactly what they came here to do. This is not an accident. And if, I don't care how much you believe in evolution, we've got like a zillion coincidences going on here. It's like, okay, how many more you want to add? You know, and it would mean that if evolution was the only way that things grow, particularly humans, there would be so many preconditions that make Earth what it is that you could never find another planet probably in our galaxy, maybe in the whole universe, that would support human life. But that's kind of weird because it's the antithesis of what most evolutionists believe. And it's more what some people who are highly religious and anti-evolutionary believe. The truth is it's both. We have a spiritual development and we have an evolutionary development, and the two are joined together to make what it means to be human. The plan of our planet was to do everything that has happened down to the umpteenth level of changes and critical elements that have made life as it is. There are no accidents. We would not be who we are today if you change even relatively small parts of the plan, because each part had a crucial element that eventually led to, you know, it's like the butterfly effect, eventually led to another crucial element, et cetera, and we would not be able to survive this world, nor would we be so creative with God in this world if it wasn't all planned out beforehand. That doesn't mean we don't have choice. As a matter of fact, part of the plan is that we do have choice. We have an incredible, phenomenal level of choices. More than most souls and their incarnates have in most other worlds. Even third race of other planets, because this planet is an extremophile type planet in which we are combating the worst kinds of evil as one part of the plan. And you might say, well, come on, you're almost out of time. You're going to pull that on us. Okay, I'll let the genie out of the bottle a little bit. What is another part of the plan? Another part of the plan, which we will talk about next week, and I'm almost out of time right now, is that we are also here to create some unique gifts beyond just the question of fighting evil that will support speeding up the development, particularly of human life, on easier planets, simpler planets than Earth, as well as difficult planets like Earth. So that's another reason we are here. And it's part of the plan. And boy, am I out of time. Okay, so for next week, we're going to go into the plan part two. I hope this is interesting. I'm fascinated by that. Maybe I'm the only one listening to me. Who knows? And we do have another commercial coming on after I'm done yakking here. So please keep listening, and then we'll sign off the whole show. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.